It's time for Raghav Gupta of Nimble Labs to crystallize his dream into a presentation that will convince and win over the judges. But first, he's up for some teasing by the panel.
Good afternoon, all. So, hi, my name is Raghav.
I have a question for you.
Before I start?
Yes.
Yes, please go on.
You are 23, you look handsome, you have such a lovely smile. Do you have a girlfriend?
I would not like to say that on stage.
So that means you're looking out. Go ahead, Raghav.
So hi, I'm Raghav. I'm one of the co-founders at Nimble Labs, where we are making everyday eating conveniently possible for you. There does not exist a convenient way for young working professionals in fast-paced cities to eat truly healthy, preservative-free food every day.
We just kept made everything live on our platform, and we were playing internally to test it out if everything is working fine. And while all of us, my co-founders and team members, we were discussing that the platform will not go down, right? Everything will work well. And then we started inviting up our friends and family, and people started playing. And then it became 2 days, 3 days, the platform didn't go down and everything was running smooth. And that's where we realized, yeah, we have made something really good. And from there to like having just 5 to 10 people playing right now, our platform is scale is almost 4,000 plus people can play at any point of time.
We used to have one player who we used to contact, you know, when his match was there, if he's checked in. Mm. So his mom used to pick up and be like, you know, he has an exam tomorrow, don't pick up. That kid, he ended up winning, I think, close to 20,000 rupees. After that, his mom used to ensure that whenever the tournament was there, like, she picked up next and she's like, yes, I'll go call him immediately to ensure that he would play for his tournament.
Unbelievable.
Hello everyone, thank you for downloading the latest episode of the Indian Startup Show. Today you will hear some of the best guests I've spoken to over the past 12 months. You will hear from Raghav Gupta, the co-founder of Nimble Labs. He came on the show in November 2017. His team have built a personal cooking assistant called Julia. So we talk about his appearance on TV that you just heard, how they've developed the robot since we last spoke. He talks about raising finance, setting up offices in China and California. Next up, we have Nitesh Salvi. He's the founder and CEO of Pocket 52 on building India's largest poker platform. So he talks about how he went from playing poker in the late nights in his student dorm with friends to building India's largest poker platform. And last but not least, we have Yash Parini. He's the co-founder of the Indian Gaming League. He talks about building India's most popular esports league and the booming Indian esports scene. So sit back and enjoy some of the best moments of the Indian Startup Show. Hello, Raghav. Thank you for coming back on the show today.
Hey, thanks, Neil. Thanks for having me over.
What's been going on since we last spoke to you in November 2017?
Oh, so the last time we talked, we were still just maybe a bunch of 5-6 people trying to build a bot that could cook food. Mm-hmm. We're still a bunch of people trying to build a bot that cooks food, but now we've grown in number and have expanded across 3 different offices, raised venture capital from some of the brightest entrepreneurs and investors in the venture ecosystem, mm-hmm. and are now finally ready to put our robot in the houses of people across California to get their feedback and continue to improve this before we're ready for mass production.
Excellent. So it's a curry cooking robot called Julia. Just explain to our listeners how it works.
So when we started out about, when we last talked about 17, 18 months back, this were the idea we had was of building a curry cooking robot. But now as we continue to develop it, we realized that the same technology that is used to cook curries can actually be used to cook not just curries, but almost everything that can be cooked on a stovetop. Now we're expanding our repertoire of recipes into stir fries, pastas, soups, salads, rice bowls, and pretty much anything that can be cooked on a stovetop. So now we don't call it a curry cooking robot, but we call it Julia, your personal cooking assistant.
So in terms of the stir fry, how would that work then? Would I have to chop my own vegetables then, or do I need to download an app?
So because I don't have a visual, the best way to explain this would be that we have a cooking, that we have a coffee machine, but for food.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah.
So it looks just like, it's just like a coffee machine. You load in the ingredients, you tap cook, and out comes your food instead of coffee. You have to load in different chopped or prepped ingredients into different compartments. There are compartments for oil and water. There are compartments for solid ingredients like milk, broccoli, florets, meat, grains, or anything else that you can think of. Other smaller ingredients like spices, herbs, vinegars, etc. And yeah, that's pretty much it. So we have more or less all ingredients covered. And then there's a there's a place for you to put in ingredients.
Okay.
There's a place where a pan goes in. Pan has a stirrer inbuilt.
Okay.
And it is housed on top of an induction cooktop. So as soon as you choose a recipe on the screen of this apparatus and load in the ingredients that are that the screen tells you, it just cooks the food automatically by putting the right ingredients into the cooking vessel or the pan at the right time, heating the food for the right temperature, stirring the food, monitoring changes in heat, monitoring changes in color, monitoring changes in doneness, and basically giving you a very delicious meal without you having to spend time either stirring your food or watching over your food or just standing near your food.
No, sounds exciting.
That, hope that explains.
Yeah, yeah, no, definitely explains it. And you also appeared on the CNBC India's version of Shark Tank called Pulse the Venture.
Yeah.
Talk about that experience of being on TV.
That experience was really nice. It was the first time we appeared on national television. It was fantastic to see myself on video pitching to a bunch of investors. Mm-hmm. What that experience did was it helped us build much more clarity around our message. Like, how can we deliver the same message in a very crisp manner to people who don't have a lot of time to listen to you?
Mm-hmm. We played a snippet at the start of the show because the judge asked you if you had a girlfriend before you even pitched.
And the good news is my then girlfriend is now my fiance.
Okay.
we'll soon be getting married.
That's good news.
People who were interested in Julia found CNBC's coverage to be a credible source of truth, that Julia or what these people are building is actually a business and not probably a hobby project. Did help us get a lot of inquiries on the website.
Mm.
So people did reach our website and signed up to see our product. But then we changed our market focus from India to the United States. So those inquiries were basically only helpful to us to the extent that we could use them as a trial market in India.
Okay, and why did you focus from India to America then?
We realized a lot of real challenges that were not visible in India, but were more visible in the US, primarily because of the way that the workforce is structured here versus in the US. In India, we don't have a dearth of manpower. There is never a shortage of manpower, and most people have cooks who can who come to their place every day, maybe even three times a day, and cook food for them.
Mm-hmm.
For a very affordable rate. I in Bangalore, I think I pay not upwards of probably like $120 to $130 a month for a cook that comes to my house 6 days a week, two times a day,
mm-hmm.
and cooks for four people. In the US, whereas manpower is scarce,
mm-hmm.
And it's hard to get to cook on your own. So whereas the next best alternative to Julia, to a cooking robot here, is the domestic help. In the US, the next best alternative is cooking yourself. And so people feel that there's a greater need of a robot that cooks food for you.
Cool. What's the business model now? Because last time I spoke to you, I think it was like $300. Has that changed, or is it now a new business model?
Yeah, that has changed.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier, when we were... So because we shifted our focus to the US market, so when we shifted our focus to the US, we realized that customers were much more demanding, and they demanded a higher quality product as opposed to the kind of product that Indians demanded. So we have improved the reliability, the safety, and the quality output of the food in our prototype. With that, the price of the prototype has also increased. We have not yet zeroed down on the pricing of the robot,
mm-hmm.
as of now, but what we're doing is we're giving out the robot to early users or alpha testers for $75 a month as of now. What this does is it helps early testers get a feel of the product, use it at their house without committing to it long term, because it's still an early product and not a fully functional one. And what it gives us is insights into how consumers are using it, how often they're using it, what problems they're facing, so that we can continue to build a better product before shipping it out to the masses.
Yeah, sounds interesting. So when you're getting feedback, you know, what insights have you gained? Anything surprising?
The most interesting thing we've realized is that control over food trumps convenience for most consumers. What I mean by that is people want to have a certain control over their food. They want to control the amount of ingredients that are going inside their food. They want to control the amount of spices. They want to control the taste. They want to control the flavors and other things. They basically want to ensure that their food is cooked exactly the way they want it. And as long as that happens, they want convenience.
No, interesting stuff.
In obtaining that same food.
Yeah.
What we were perhaps doing earlier was we were making it easier for them to obtain food, which is giving them more convenience. But we were changing the output, which was we were giving them less control and more convenience. That has now changed. So what we now do is we let users. So essentially, users want to be able to change each aspect of the food, and we now allow it by letting them tweak the amount of oil, the amount of salt, removing a certain ingredient from the recipe, and so on. And that we do at a very in a very convenient way for them.
What's like the goals of the research then? What was it you're trying to sort of find out, as it were?
Yeah, so the goal of the research that we were doing was to figure out who is our earliest target market and who has the most dire need of getting a robot that cooks for them. And what stood out for us was that dual-income households who have no kids or dual-income households who have kids who are less than 10 years of age are the most time-strapped people who also want fresh food at home. And we found out the needs of especially people who had kids who were younger. We did not realize earlier how picky kids were when it came to food. Now we know that that they're really picky, and only the mothers know what sort of food their kid would like. And so the threshold of customizability or the levels of customizability that we were building in earlier have increased because of that feedback, that people wanted more customizability. We also understood the biggest value prop that people got out of Julia, which is the cooking robot. The biggest value props for these people who had kids was they saved a lot of time. Like, I'm surprised how super mothers or superhuman mothers juggle between work, between entertaining their kids, and between cooking food every day. And now at least the cooking piece is taken away from them and they save a lot of time. B, the second value prop for them is they don't have to default to eating the same four dishes that they've learned to cook every day. Now they get much more variety, whereas earlier they would have had to spend time on YouTube or on recipe blogs to learn a new recipe and to give it to their family. Now families don't have to do that because Julia just gives them new recipes every single day without them having to learn them. And the third value prop that we understood was, as I mentioned, customizability.
Excellent stuff. And how are you capturing this feedback then? Is there any special software?
The way we're capturing this feedback is, so I'll tell you the process that we followed.
Yeah, go for it.
We realized that feedback and noise, it's very difficult for people to segregate between feedback and noise. And the way to segregate between feedback and noise, so the way to differentiate between feedback and noise is by differentiating who your customer might be and who your customer might not be. Anything that's coming from a person who might not end up becoming your customer is noise. So while taking feedback, the first thing we did was we qualified people who were most likely to be customers. by getting them to sign up on our website and go through some friction in signing up, in giving their email IDs, phone numbers, social profiles, zip codes. That was enough of a friction for them to show that they were really interested in this product. Second level of friction that we introduced in the process was by actually, people who were more likely to be customers were people who allowed us to come to their home and spend 1.5-2 hours at their home, you know, showing our prototype to them. People are private and they don't want anyone to just come home and show a demo of their product at their home. So people who signed up on a website and let us into their house to see the demo were most likely customers, and we listened to their feedback. The software we used was very simple recording, or the equipment that we used for getting this feedback was very simple recording equipment.
Yeah.
We carried a camera, we carried a gimbal, we carried a microphone, and we recorded all the interactions that they made with our robot. We recorded all the questions they asked us and got that back to our home office base, used an audio transcription service to extract all the audio and then basically work with it.
No, interesting stuff. A lot of listeners who may be interested in doing custom development on their idea. Mm-hmm. What advice would you give our listeners on that?
My advice to most listeners who are interested in customer development would be to first not talk about your product at all to the consumers. Maybe just get on a call with them or have a face-to-face meeting. Give them a broad idea of what space you're in and ask them questions around the problems they might have in that space. So for us, if that is a cooking problem, the way we would approach this in the initial days was we would go to people and we would say, hey, I'm Raghav, I'm from this food company, and we're trying to understand the problems people face during cooking every day or during consuming food every day, and I would just like to talk to you about the problems you face in the kitchen. Now, because we did not ever tell them that we were building cooking robot, they would not get biased and would very honestly tell us all the problems that they faced in the kitchen, whether it was pre-cooking prep work, whether it was the cooking work, whether it was the post-cooking cleanup, whether it was meal planning, grocery shopping, etc. They gave us an entire lowdown on all the problems that they had. So once you've abstracted your product away from these conversations, you get enough insights to focus on your product and build a product that only solves problems that people talked to you about without you necessarily introducing your product. That is step one. And then step two would be go back to the same customer saying, hey, you told me about these A, B, C, and you told me about these three problems, A, B, and C. I heard your problems and, you know, came up with this product concept. Like, don't build the product, just maybe just make a set of slides or a website. And so I actually came up with this product. What do you think about this product? Mm-hmm. And continue to hear out what problems they potentially foresee with your product. Once it is still in the sketch mode and they're continuing to give you feedback, only then you build the actual physical thing, which takes the most amount of time to build, and then let them use it and then continue to give you feedback.
Interesting stuff. No, that's good though. So you actually went over to San Francisco then, or California, and did the trials yourself. So you went into people's houses. What was that like?
So it was great because we had, just like I was describing you the process, because we had ourselves gone through that process, talked to people, learned about the problems, shown them concepts, gotten feedback. The third time when we actually went to their house with a prototype or a product, we actually had nailed down most of the problems that they had in their kitchens. Mm-hmm. So now we were able to get a much deeper understanding of their problems. What we did was we drove across the San Francisco Bay Area, Los Angeles, San Diego, and demoed it to 20 or so families. We would lug around our 50-pound prototype in the back of our cars with all the debugging supplies and whatnot, and set this up at their house and have a very structured interview process with them about, you know, what they were liking, what they were not liking, how they were interacting with it, how they could see the product fit into their lives and so on, and use that to continue to refine the product and give our technical team more insight. During the daytime, this is what we would do. Our product would also fail at times. And so during the second half of the day at night, we would just come back home, open the product apart, try to fix as many issues as we could, you know, and then on the next day, go back on the road and show the prototype to the next set of people. While we were doing this, we started understanding the language that that people resonated with, and ultimately also got at least 30 or 40% of the people we talked to pay us money to get this into their houses.
That's good.
So what's next is that we would put this in the houses of people, let them use it for an extended period of time,
yeah,
and see the kind of problems they face when they use it not for an hour, but for an entire week or an entire month.
No, interesting stuff. You mentioned offices in China. What goes on in China, and you know, what were the challenges of setting up in China?
We opened an office in China because specifically we opened it in a city called Shenzhen, because Shenzhen is the factory for the world. All consumer electronics products, from the TV that you use to perhaps the phone you use, is manufactured in Shenzhen. So they have a very vibrant ecosystem around manufacturing, a design for assembly and for sourcing of components. So our prototyping cycles reduce multifold. Let me just give you a scenario. Scenario is, let us say we're building a certain part, and we feel that, and we realize that it requires a design change. Earlier, what would happen is we would require a design change. We would give it to a vendor. The vendor would make the design change in 4 or 5 days, ship it back to us, and the design change would reach us in say 7 or 8 days. So in a week's time, we were only able to make one design change. In China, what happens is that same design change is done in a matter of 2 days. So instead of one change a week, we're now able to do 4 changes a week.
Wow.
Which is 4x our productivity.
Cool. And can you now produce in bulk now that you've got this base in China?
We are not focusing on producing in bulk right now. We feel that it is very important for tens of people to be using our product and giving us very valuable feedback before we lock down some of the feature changes that we need to lock down. And only once we've locked down those decisions would be manufacturing in bulk.
Mm-hmm.
But we're still some time away from bulk manufacturing. Mm-hmm. It'll take about a year or more for us to do that.
A year or more, no worries. And you mentioned investment. I think it's your first round of capital. Talk about that. How much did you raise, and what was the equity?
So we haven't disclosed the amount or the equity that we had to divest, but we're currently funded by 0 to 1 Capital, Waterbridge Ventures, and Binny Bansal. 0 to 1 Capital and Waterbridge Ventures are VC funds based in India, focusing on startups that are really solving hard problems. Binny Bansal is the co-founder at Flipkart, which is India's largest e-commerce company. Company was recently acquired by Walmart for $17 billion. But not just that, we're also funded by Sameh Kohli and Akash Gupta, who are co-founders at Grey Orange Robotics, which is perhaps one of the largest warehousing robotics players in the world. Because most of our investors have been entrepreneurs themselves in one, either right now or sometime in the past, they don't just bring in capital to our company, but also a lot of valuable advice that helps us, you know, build this company the way it should be built.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good news. What kind of advice have they given you then?
For example, the Grey Orange Robotics is a robotics company which was started by 2 college graduates, mm-hmm. and is now worth about $500 million.
Wow.
And their most recent investor was Peter Thiel. And because the founders started straight out of college, built a robotics business from India for the global market, they very much understand the challenges that we also face and keep pushing us to solve some of those challenges very early on. One of the very valuable advice they gave us was to set up the China office.
Mm-hmm.
We were not in favor of setting up that China office. office. But Samir and Akash really pushed us hard, saying that, you know, you cannot make this business succeed unless you set up, unless you, you know, get out of your comfort zone and open a China office. So that was one thing. The second thing they really pushed hard on was to build, to was, so they pushed us to build the worst product that we can, but in the fastest way possible. Basically, they pushed us to ship whatever product we can and basically put it in consumers' houses. We had this grand vision of a product that would solve all problems that a consumer would have, but they advised us not to focus on all those 100 problems, but focus on the smallest problem that we could solve in the fastest way possible and just basically ship it to the house of 4 people, 5 people.
No, good. That's good advice. That in terms of the competition, then there must be other startups doing what you're doing. How do you sort of deal with the competition now?
Most of the consumer robotics startups that are solving problems in the food space are still in similar stages to us. So not many companies have shipped so far because it's a hard problem to solve, to build something that cooks food for you automatically. So right now, we're not really worried about competition or even keeping track of what the competition is doing. We're currently only focused on building a product that cooks food for you in the most convenient way possible at the press of a button. There are a lot of companies.
Yeah.
They are spread across different nations, but currently we're not focusing on what they're doing so much.
Okay. And also, you demoed this at the TechCrunch Robotics and AI conference. It's been a big occasion for you. How did that go?
Yeah, that was really interesting because the Robotics and AI conference people, or the organizers, wanted us to pay. So for us to get a booth at the Robotics and AI conference, we had to shell out thousands of dollars.
Wow.
But we did not want to shell out those $1,000. So we basically displayed at the conference without shelling out a single
nice.
Without shelling out a single dollar. We were able to do that, and that was the most interesting part for us.
We basically drove
to the conference venue with a prototype because we were already doing these trials to consumers every day. We always had the prototype in the back of our trunk.
Oh, nice.
So we had no plans to demonstrate there. We just reached there to attend the conference. And then we were like, hey, outside the main conference, there are these tables or there are these platforms where we potentially can put a prototype. And we also see plug points. If we just display it here, should they stop us from displaying? Well, they shouldn't, because no one knows that we haven't paid money. So let us just get it from the car and we'll set it up here. And if anyone stops us, we'll just take it back. And luckily for us, no one stopped us. They found what we were doing interesting, and they probably thought that it was adding to the experience of the conference attendees. So they let us demo our bot there.
Oh, nice. That's good. That's a good one. That
also got us another TV feature, by the way.
Did it?
Yeah. So a firm called, a news channel called CGTN was making videos of the latest and greatest that was happening at TechCrunch.
Uh-huh.
And they sat through our demo and shot the footage and made it live wherever they're channels were.
Oh, nice. What did you cook?
Yeah, we cooked a rotini mushroom pasta.
Oh, okay. Oh, nice.
So it was basically a white sauce pasta with a lot of mushrooms in it.
Mm-hmm.
And people loved it. At the end of the demo, so there was also a food delivery robot company that was displaying there. And what we did was we prepared our pasta on the robot, then we put it into the delivery robot.
Mm-hmm.
And the delivery robot delivered robot cooked pasta to the attendees.
Oh, nice. So at the moment, this is a B2C. Would you not focus on B2B? You know, you can go to offices, colleges, and sell this as well.
That is certainly a use case that we might want to explore in the future. Right now, we are currently solely focused on solving the home cooking problem. The reason for that is that the incentives of restaurateurs are not aligned with the incentives of people who cook at home. The incentive of a restaurateur is to deliver food in the fastest way possible and to earn the largest amount of profit, which means that they might not use the highest quality ingredients and even put preservatives in the food or use pre-cooked food, which is something that does not align with what we want. What we want is for people to eat the freshest food possible, have control over what ingredients are going inside the food, have full control on the traceability, and that is more aligned with the home cooking use case as of now. That being said, as we improve our technology, we might expand into B2B use cases as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you're still doing the alpha trials. How long will you do the alpha trials?
Currently, the trials are on hold.
Yeah.
Amid the coronavirus situation. Mm-hmm. But as soon as it settles down, we will be on the road again. And we intend to continue to do these trials for at least a period of 8 to 9 months from now, because that data or that information will really help us build a product that then solves the problem of more than 10,000 people across. And we don't want to half-ass it. We don't want to build something that might give problems to a lot of people only because we were in a lot of hurry to ship the product soon.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned coronavirus. How are you keeping productive, as they say? Or are you being productive in this lockdown stage?
We are really trying to be productive, but it's hard, especially for a company like ours, which is not a pure software company. We have engineers who have to work on mechanisms. We have engineers who have to work with electronics. We have engineers who have to assemble different plastic parts and motors and, you know, screens and things like that together. So they need a working functional lab. And in lockdown state, even in a remote work from home situation, it's extremely hard for them to do that.
Mm.
The work has been affected, but we're trying to push hard against it and trying to use this opportunity to upskill our team by giving them more learning opportunities and give more output once they join, you know, their labs back. The second way we're affected is that we have operations across different geographies.
Mm-hmm.
And because movement across these geographies is restricted, movement of goods from China to Bangalore and movement of human capital from Bangalore to the US and vice versa, our development operations and our user trial operations are also affected.
Mm-hmm. Actually, we never talked about your co-founder on the last show. Who's the co-founder and how did you guys meet?
So my co-founder is Rohan Malhotra.
Mm-hmm.
The two of us went to the same high school together.
Mm-hmm.
And I've known each other for close to 15 years now. And Rohan was a mechanical engineer. I was a electronics engineer.
Yeah.
And when you're doing something in robotics, the three things you need are mechanics, electronics, and software.
Mm-hmm.
So software is something that we taught ourselves and also hired people.
And in the early days, how did you divide up the roles?
In the early days, both of us were techies. So Rohan taught himself electronics and software and used to work developing the control systems of the robot, whereas used to act as a mechanical engineer and, you know, work on the mechanics of the bot. Although my training is in electronics and Rohan's training is in mechanical engineering, switching these roles even amongst ourselves helped ensure that that we had a sounding board to talk to whenever there was something we did not understand.
Mm-hmm.
So earlier days, those were the roles.
Last few questions. How has this startup changed you then since we last spoke? Is it still exciting?
It is still exciting. How the startup has changed me on a personal level since we last talked is that working on my startup has made me become much more comfortable with uncertainty. So whereas earlier, not knowing what the future holds for me, like even that thought used to make me feel so scared, now that is not the case. Now having run the startup, I know that I am prepared for the worst, and whatever happens will be for the best, now more comfortable with uncertainty. Mm-hmm. So that's how it's changed for me. Mm-hmm.
But before you got the capital or the investment, did you nearly run out of money then? Or
It was quite tough. Like, not having the money and still continuing to push hard was tough. But I'm really thankful to our team who continued to believe in us, took salary cuts, and continued to push hard, believing that the money would come. It was hard. It took us a lot of time.
Do you still get like people say, you know, what the hell is this? Why are you doing this?
Not really.
No.
I don't. Maybe people would have said that 1 year back.
Yeah.
Now, I don't remember anyone telling us, why the hell are you doing this? This does not make sense.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Good stuff. And last few questions then. You know, what advice would you give our listeners about building a startup?
Don't fall in love with your product. Fall in love with the problem that your customers are facing, though, and then obsessively try hard to solve the problem. Do not try to find a problem for the product you've already fallen in love with.
Mm-hmm. Great. And if people want more information on you and Julia, what must they do?
They could just go to our website. It's eatwithnimble.com. And our website would have most of the information they would need to stay updated. There's also a box where they could just enter their email address, and we can and we'll send them a short digest every month to keep them abreast with the latest happenings at Nimble.
Awesome stuff. Excellent. And we're gonna play out with some music. This is your brother and his friend. Set this up for us.
Yeah, they're playing Wonderwall. This was about like 10 years back in high school when they decided to play this song on Teacher's Day.
Excellent. Raghav, thank you for coming on the show today.
Thanks, Neil.
Awesome stuff.
Today was gonna be the day that they're gonna throw it back to you. By now you should have somehow realized what you gotta do. You're gonna be the one that saves me.
Hi, Nitesh. Thank you for coming on the Indian Startup Show today.
Thank you, Neil. Thank you for inviting me to the show here.
What was your desire to do this?
When I was in college, 2010, we used to play poker with in our hostel with all of college friends. Okay. And I have burned a lot of nights into poker.
Okay. Instead of studying.
So that's how I got in touch with this game. Uh-huh. I wasn't ever serious about poker till 2012, 13. And then I graduated from IIT Bombay. I started my own education venture, mm-hmm. edtech company, Plansys. It was my first venture. I started in 2011. Mm-hmm. And while I was working for Plansys, I figured out a couple of online poker platforms, and that's how I started playing online. Till 2016, I played on a couple of Indian platforms and international platform as well. And then while I spent more and more time playing online poker, I realized that there is a great potential and good opportunity in Indian market, mm-hmm. where I did not find good platforms which are providing right product services or using the right technology in Indian market. So that is how I got in touch with poker, and I started Pocket 52 in 2018.
So you're building this out of your own passion of playing poker, is that right?
Yeah, perfectly. I as an entrepreneur, I'm doing startup from 2011, mm-hmm. but working for Pocket 52, building Pocket 52, I love this game for almost 10 years now. Been a player myself, so that's where if you like something, you love your work, then the output is really great. Yeah, I enjoy the game, I love the game, I play the game, and I'm also building this company.
Awesome stuff. So the most important question then, how good are you then?
So before starting this company, I have made some money, definitely. Uh-huh. I can call myself as a recreational come semi-professional player.
Nice.
But after starting Pocket 52, now I know that if I dedicate more time playing, I can do really well. But unfortunately, I don't get time to play poker now. Okay. My most of time goes into building this business. Okay. Cards.
Let's go back to the start then. What did the first version of Pocket 52 like?
So while we were starting Pocket 52 back in 2018 in early days, we spent almost 6-7 months just on figuring out the product, the idea, working more and more on the differentiation that we wanted to do from the existing market, mm-hmm. Most of our competitor. Because mm-hmm. In poker, if you have done the technology in-house, you have built the entire technology, it doesn't mean that you can do well compared to all your other comp. And one thing that we realized and figured out, which we feel that most of the real money gaming companies in India are failing to understand, liquidity, mm-hmm. how many people you have playing on your platform. For real money gaming, that's the most important thing. The more and more people you see on the platform, your trust is more, you feel more secure, you have more options to play with other players. Mm-hmm. And that is where we focused. We have created an individual B2C platform as Pocket 52, almost spending a year. We launched in December 2018. We raised initial two rounds of funds from a couple of angel investors and a seed fund, Special Invest, based out of Bangalore. So they were the early one investor who trusted us and thought that can do something really well in online poker. Though the industry was already competitive and there were so many platforms with 3 to 4 good names out there in market. Mm. But the uniqueness that we had was completely on technology and product, not working on marketing, not working on providing more bonus or creative option, but to actually build a scalable product, beating the competition with technology. So I'll give you an idea example of what different we have done. And most of the time, investor also asks to entrepreneurs, is your product market fit, or what differentiation you have comparative to your competitor? What is the unique thing which is there in your idea, which makes you different? Mm. And that's what we have done. We launched a B2C platform, and in initial 6 to 7 months, we ran the platform, the revenues increased month on month, and after 4 to 5 months, I've started seeing the decline. Mm-hmm. And that is where we thought, okay, things are not working out from here on. Either we need more and more money to pump in the market, do more marketing and acquire more users, or we need to figure out something else. And that's where the idea of Poker Network came into the picture, where we spend another 4 to 5 months building a technology of poker network. So currently, Pocket 52 as a website, I can call this as a gaming SaaS network, mm-hmm. where we provide B2B solution to any company in India who wants to launch poker. We provide a 3 weeks plug-and-play solution to anyone. They can just come, take our products in 2 to 3 weeks, and they can launch poker in the market. Mm-hmm. The best part here is we actually collaborate, pool the traffic between among all the network partners, so that traffic on each and every platform is maximum. From having 200 to 300 people playing live on our platform in September, October 2019, we are currently having 3,500 plus concurrent users on our platform. So in 8 months, almost the platform has grown to 15 to 20X.
Well, how do you feel about that then? Is that what you expected?
Yes, so definitely it feels very good to be on the first position in the Indian market while talking about concurrent users or live users playing on the network. It is a collaborative effort of all the platforms which are part of our network. But I can definitely say with this past 6 to 7 months, the target that I have in mind for the next quarters or next years is definitely bigger than what we are doing right.
So was this a success from day one then?
Definitely. So we launched as a beta version and we invited most of our known networks, family and friends to play on our platform. And when we saw people are depositing money and the money is coming in the company and then they are playing live, it was an amazing feel. So just I'll talk about the night that we were launching. Mm-hmm. So we took the platform live at like around, I guess, 10 p.m. It wasn't live. We just kept made everything live on our platform, and we were playing internally to test it out if everything is working fine. Mm. And while all of us, my co-founders and team members, we were discussing that the platform will not go down, right? Everything will work well. And then we started inviting up our friends and family, and people started playing. And then it became 2 days, 3 days, the platform didn't go down and everything was running smooth. And that's where we realized, yeah, we have made something really good. And from there to like having just 5 to 10 people playing right now, our platform is scale is almost 4,000 plus people can play at any point of time.
So you don't have any sleepless nights anymore then?
No, I won't say that. we surely have this sleepless night right now also. And currently, like, it's just poker, but at this point, we are now looking at launching a few more games also. So my team is definitely up for 24/7, building more games and taking things ahead. We are targeting to build a concurrency of 15,000 plus playing on a platform in couple of next few months.
Who are these users then? Are these like students who should be studying it?
Not just students. If I talk about the age group, it's definitely between 2022 to early 30s, I'll say. Mm. So these are the target audience which are playing more on the platform. Mm. People who are working audience, like at least the semi-professional, professional people, they are the one who has done their colleges and also like maybe in their professional career made some money and then figured out, okay, poker is something which they love and also they have skill to make money. Mm. The average age group, I'll say 2022 to early 30s. Okay.
And how much are they spending, how much are they staying online and how much are they spending online per visit?
Yeah, so we have almost 40% of our users playing at least 1.5 hours, 2 hours a day regularly. And then the 60% are the users which are not very regular. They come often few days a week. So that's what we see, like a certain percentage of our users, very regular, they like the platform and they are the one who plays very regular. And then the certain percentage which are coming and playing based on like the time they have, suitable time.
Mm-hmm. Is poker the main card game in India?
India then? Is there a history of...
Yes, so poker definitely like came from Western market in Indian market. Mm. It's a more famous into the college crowd. And like as I mentioned, I started from my hostel life, played with my friends in hostel days. Similarly, we have a festival called Diwali in India. Mm-hmm. And in Diwali, card games are very famous. Mm-hmm. So from last few years, I have seen families playing, even in our family, we play poker on Diwali festival. So, and then there is Rummy as well, which is very old game and famous game from my father and even grandfather's day. Mm-hmm. So they play Rummy more. But yeah, poker, I think it has grown more and more in past decade in India. Mm-hmm. And in current years, it is growing more. Currently,
what's it like playing poker with your family then? Is there any arguments? Any bad losers?
No. So if I play in family,
do you let them win?
Game. No, it always become a free chip game. We start with money, but no one pays the money.
And in terms of who taught you to play poker then?
No one. Like it started as like Zynga Poker on Facebook, and then we started playing with $50 or $100 in hostel life with all of friends. Mm. I never used any strategy or data, math, probability while I was playing in college life. But there were two of my friends in college. They used to win always, and I always used to think like, what different they do, which we don't do. They always win. And every session that we play, they go out with some money. Mm. And now I can understand like the difference between them and us while we were in college. Mm. So yeah, after 2015-16, I started focusing more on this game, looked at it from complete different perspective, not just playing with the ranges or cards that I have in hand and just go with gut feeling. Okay, this guy does not have this. Mm. Let's go all in, try to do bluff. But now we play more with data, with the hand range that we have, the standard gameplay that one should do. Mm. So we try to avoid mistakes and play more professionally.
Mm. So it's like there's a psychology of poker, right? You know, how to read people.
Yeah, so poker actually teaches you a lot of things. Psychology, strategy, you read other people, there is maths involved, probability involved. So if like the thing you mentioned about reading other people, now you have different streets on the poker, different bets happening. Mm. And you actually analyze from the start of the hand what happened. If you're playing live poker, you also focus on the movement of the players as well. Mm. So whether he was comfortable or he has done the bet very, he has taken some time to bet, how much time he's spending on thinking from there to the bet sizing that he has done from each street, from starting what position you are and what position your opponent is. So a couple of these things, if you put together and then understand, it's easy to know whether the player is trying to bluff or not. If you just go with your gut feeling, that's not the way to read your opponent in poker. Mm. But you need to understand, and you need to have things in mind from start to end. Whenever you're trying to figure out, you need to analyze everything what happened on the table.
And obviously you raised finance as well. Talk about that.
Okay, so that's where the struggle part comes in.
Okay.
So when I was starting in 2018, I already had a good background of starting a venture. So the earlier company that I started, I raised almost $5 million funds. Mm-hmm. I sold it to a public listed company in India. So as an entrepreneur, people have seen success with me, and I had the experience of building the business, building the teams, raising funds in the market. But when I was building Pocket 52, went out and raising money for poker, I actually faced a lot of challenge raising money from investor due to a couple of things which were very standard, almost decent competitive market with 3 to 4 good names out there in market which are doing really well. One of our international company launched in India when we were planning to start. It has been like 1 year already by 2018. Mm. For Poker Star, which was world number one,
yeah,
poker platform. So they have been 1 year in India already by 2018. These were the challenges I faced in the market. And then there is one poker player who is actually till 2016-17, he was India's one of best PLO poker players, now focused more on the business side. But Mr. Bigya Sagar, he actually invested in us as a first angel investor, believing that we have the potential to build a product and can compete with this market with the thoughts we have for product and technology. And after him, a couple of more angels joined in, and then the seed fund, the Special Invest, they came in and they invested in us. So I think I spoke to almost 150 to 200 investors for 5 months to raise the funds. Did not get a single check for initial 5 months. But then when Abhigya Sagar invested, we got almost 10 plus investors investing in our company. Last year, October 2019, we raised fund from Gamescraft, $1.75 million, which is currently a leading Rummy company in India. I think now we are in position where I am not going out in market to raise funds, but investors are coming to me to invest in our company.
Awesome. What kept you going then? Because obviously 150 rejections. Most people would give up.
I think that's where being a second time entrepreneur is helped me in this situation, because running Plansys for almost 6-7 years gave me the idea of the failures and success as well. Raising funds when you go out in market, the timeline that you need to have, and at the same time the rejections that you will get from the market. So I was keen and focused on raising funds. I knew that rejections are going to come, and while we were getting all of these rejections, we were continuously building our product and going ahead. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, you must have done a lot of presentations, lots of pitch decks. What would you say is the most important thing you need to put in, you know, or to tell investors?
Okay, while you're out in market raising funds and speaking to investors, I think the most important thing that they wanted to understand, they wanted to focus on the market and the differentiation that you have from your competitor, the strategies that you build to go ahead of your competition. I don't see investors if they're getting 100 ideas, it's very rare to get even one single idea which is unique in the market. If I'm thinking something in India, someone is doing in any place of the world at this point of time. What matters how well are you executing, how are you gonna competing with your competition, and how are you gonna go ahead. So that's where I focus more when I speak with my investors, what differentiation we have from the market and what strategies we have to surpass them, surpass their revenues, make our company bigger and better.
Obviously you said you were a two-time entrepreneur. What advice would you give to first-time entrepreneurs? What should they be focusing on first?
Most of the time I've seen with first-time entrepreneurs, including myself as well, we get some ideas and we think that the idea is very good, and we start focusing on executing or taking the idea ahead. I'll advise the first-time entrepreneurs to go deeper into the idea, start figuring out the competition, start figuring out what your competition is doing, and the each and every uniqueness that you find in your idea, whether the same has been done by someone else or not. Most of the time first-time entrepreneurs thinks the ideas, and they actually miss out to compare with the competition and start doing the same thing which someone has done with lesser experience, and then they realize, figure out after a couple of months, year, the idea is not working out. That's where I think one should have more focus. The second most important thing is team, your co-founding team as well as the team that you're building. Focus on people where your team can come and execute. You can learn from them. Don't build a team where you need to go out and tell them what they need.
Yeah, you mentioned focus. How do you focus then? Because if I'm a startup entrepreneur, I'm doing like 10 things at once.
Okay, so my strategy is very simple. I focus more on people, my team building, and if I have good people with me who are I can call them second layer in my company, they should be really good to take care of the other things, so I can only focus on the business side. So in my daily schedule, I spend almost half of the day thinking the challenges which are there in the company on each and every department and how we can solve them, maybe hiring or changing the processes or building the product well or anything that is needed. And half of the time I spend on figuring out the growth, the expansion of the business, things that we wanted to do next.
Yeah, you mentioned hiring and team. That's probably really important. Any tips on hiring for our listeners?
It's very difficult to actually figure out someone in just 1 hour of interview. For most of my hirings, I definitely go with, if I shortlist someone from interview and if I like them, I definitely try to get more and more insights about the person from the networks or from referral or someone the companies that they have worked. If my team members know someone in the company and can share some feedback about the person, because building team is very important. If you have right people with you, you can surely beat any idea, any company out there in the market. For hiring, one should not just go with half an hour, 1 hour of interview and take someone on board.
Actually, in terms of loyalty, in terms of the business, I can easily set up 5 different accounts on different poker sites, right? So how do you stop me from going away from your website to another website?
Okay, so one thing I mentioned about liquidity, and currently we are already number one in terms of traffic. So that gives us advantage to market to our players, that if you go out to 4 other platforms, you'll have lesser player, which means that lesser option to play and choose the players. The more and more players you have, you can choose the tables, you have a range of tables available with you. If you feel that on one table the opponents are tougher, you can go to other table as well, and that's where liquidity matters. The second part is about the tournament guaranteed. So the more and more players you have on the platform, the more and more ranges of tournaments you can offer. So as the platform is growing and becoming better, we are increasing our tournaments month on month. The third part is we also focus on providing good reward programs to our players who are playing on our platform. So let's say if you're playing on my platform, the players, you or any players, will get good rewards in terms of cashback or assets that you can purchase from our platform. So which are very competitive compared to all other platforms.
I have to ask, in terms of, you know, gambling addiction, what are your thoughts on that? Because obviously you could tell if someone's gone on the website, you know, they could be going out every day and spending so much money, etc.
Yeah, we surely follow responsible gaming. If someone is losing continuously and depositing, we keep a restriction on that. Players can come and exclude themselves for playing a certain time. We do that. We also check heavily on any frauds or anything happening on our platform, like from checking IPs to checking their devices, checking their KYCs. If any dump is happening, we check on dump. We have the algorithms on our platforms which catch people from dumping as well. So those are the things we focus so that we can provide a good overall good atmosphere for everyone to play.
What is dumping?
So let's say in Indian tax market, basically if a player is winning more than 10,000, they need to pay 30% tax. Now to save the tax, one can do another account and then chip dump the profit to another account, divide, let's say, 15,000 to 7,000 and 8,000, and then can withdraw without paying tax. So these are the things we catch, where if someone is doing this, they can probably get caught on our platform.
So I'm based in the UK. Can I use your website then?
Sorry, you can't.
Okay.
All the Indian resident having Indian documents can play on our platform. We are looking for international expansion. Once we launch in UK, I'll surely ping you in to come and play.
Okay. I'm a beginner, so you probably beat me 10 times out of 10.
No, I don't play on my platform.
Okay, excellent. Last few questions then. Yeah, are you motivated by money?
So I'll surely say money definitely motivates, but it's one part of it. I love what I do and I enjoy building a company. When I come to office daily basis, right now we are working from home, but every morning you wake up and you see more and more people coming on your platform, your customer base is increasing and you're providing services to more and more people. That gives me more enjoyment. So I aspire to take this to next level, not just poker, but launch other games and create something which is really big in gaming company out of India.
Would you consider yourself a success now? Obviously, you know, things are going well on the platform, you know, probably India's fastest growing poker website, I would say.
Not yet. We are very early stage. Mm-hmm. Things has been good, but it's been just 2 years running this. And I can call ourselves at this point a product market fit, maybe, mm-hmm. not a success. Mm-hmm. We can do another podcast maybe in a year and then we talk about this.
in terms of the payments then, is that something you've built yourself, or is that something you're using someone else's payments website?
So for payments, yeah, we use third-party companies. Mm-hmm. We have our own wallet systems and everything, mm-hmm. but yeah, for payment gateway we use third party. So we focus more on building our game infrastructure and focus on building our games more. Mm-hmm. For all the other services, we use third parties which are doing good in market and can help us grow well.
Last few questions about poker then. I have to ask, what was your biggest win then?
My biggest win, I won 2 lakhs rupees in one single pot, mm-hmm. which is around $3,000.
Oh, wow. Excellent. What was your biggest loss?
Biggest loss. So cumulative, it's maybe $5,000 plus in a session, but in one single pot, I guess $1,500 to $2,000.
Okay. So are you a risk taker then? Because obviously with poker, it's strategy and skill, but you've got to take a risk as well.
Entrepreneurs are always risk taker. I'm taking risk from last 10 years of my life, so that's where I feel I think I've chosen poker. And if I talk about playing myself, yeah, I'm a risk taker. So and then it helps playing poker, and to be successful in poker, taking risk is very, very important.
Excellent. Do you think anyone can be an entrepreneur then?
No, yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. Not just by taking risk. Yeah, there needs to be some other skill set as well. Mm. But I don't feel for entrepreneurship you need any degree or you need to be from any top colleges. Mm-hmm. Even a shopkeeper out there is an entrepreneur. A rickshawwala is an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. Someone running big companies. Overall, it's more about the skill set. Mm-hmm. And risk taking, skill set, discipline. If you have these qualities, you can be entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Excellent. Last question for people who want more information on Pocket 52. What must they do?
Okay, so for more information on Pocket 52, you can come and log into our website. It's www.pocket52.com. You can play poker, win big money on our platform. All the best for everyone who is looking to play on our platform.
Excellent. Actually, one last question in terms of marketing. What's worked, what hasn't worked for you?
So we don't focus on just providing bonuses or promotion, mm-hmm. but we focus more on the right environment that we are providing mm-hmm. to our players. So we focus on, like one thing that I would like to mention on building trust, and that's what we market more and more in the market. So we have certified ourselves as RNG certification from iTech Lab Australia, mm-hmm. and something that we have done differently from most of the companies out there. So the random number generation, which is needed for a poker company, like when you shuffle the deck or when you distribute the card, it needs to be random.
Yeah.
And for that, what we have done, we have used an algorithm which is done by Cloudflare, something similar we have done and have set up in our office in Bangalore. Mm. We have a wall of lava lamp. We do the recordings of those lava lamps, and when the lava is moving inside those lamps, and when you take pictures of those lamps, mm-hmm. Every picture is unique and different. Mm. And from there, we actually pass seed to our system to generate a random number. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it is not done by through a software algorithm, but through a real-time asset, which is not controllable by anyone. Mm-hmm. So that's how we do our real-time generation of random numbers, and that's what we market more. Mm-hmm. We provide a platform to a safe platform to come and play poker, and people, whoever is playing, they are more and more loyal to our platform.
Thank you, Nitesh. Thank you for coming to the show today.
Thank you so much. Thank you for speaking with me, and lovely experience sharing all of the things with you and the audience as well.
Awesome. Thank you, Nitesh. Bye now. Hello, Yash. Thank you for coming on the Indian Startup Show today.
Thank you, Neil, for having me.
Please tell the listeners what you do.
So currently we're aiming to build India's largest esports platform, doing that through our website and app.
And what was your desire to do this?
So it started basically when I got to know about how big esports is in America about 5 years ago. I'd gone and I'd realized, okay, this is an entire industry. Why does India not have anything like this? You know, because gaming is huge. I was a huge gamer. I still am a huge gamer. I was disappointed that, you know, there's nothing that could lead to a career way doing something you love, which is gaming. And I realized that it is happening across the world, but not in India, or it was happening, but not at the scale and pace that I wanted it to happen. Mm-hmm. So that got me looking into it. When I came back to India, I started visiting the cafes. I started researching, meeting gamers, understanding what is like the, you know, the problems. And I realized that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to try and create a solution. You know, maybe I didn't realize at that time it would be a platform where we could, you know, identify the India's best gamers, but I knew that it was something I had to be done at that time.
What were the problems that you found in the early days then?
So there were very few tournaments that were happening, and some of the tournaments they would be labeled as a scam, where the users would not get their money. So gamers were also not really incentivized to actually go to these tournaments and put their time and effort, because there was always the chance that they would not get paid their money. So there has been a lot of instances of you know, these faulty events which were kind of dodgy or somehow it didn't work. So, you know, we wanted to try and change the perception of that. You know, till now, parents in India were completely against their kids gaming. For them, it's considered a waste of time. And where in the actual, across the world, it's actually not. It's a lucrative career platform for everyone who really wants to be a gamer. Mm-hmm. Cool. So we wanted to try and put India on par with that and create the infrastructure for these gamers to climb the leaderboards, so to say, and prove their way as a gamer.
Yeah, so you've done the research. Tell me about the early days then. How did you get it off the ground?
I mean, initially, we did a lot of offline tournaments as well.
Yeah.
You know, like we would host tournaments at various places, including the Four Seasons Hotel. We had gotten a lot of avenues, but there were a lot of issues like logistics. There were like a lot of other issues, including, you know, we were constrained by our space, like limitations. You know, we couldn't have a tournament for 500 people. If you wanted to have a tournament for that many people, you'd have to take it over the span of 3 or 4 days. So we've had, there were a lot of obstructions. There were not a lot of money into it. I think this was one of the things that really paved the way for esports was demonetization that happened here. Prior to that, you know, the whole online platform was not considered legitimate, especially for esports, which was anyways, you know, borderline misunderstood. People were calling it gambling, which it's not. They didn't realize it's all skill-based. So that was basically a lot of these obstacles that we've had to overcome, including that perception of what gaming really is.
Were you making money from day one then? Was this like a success?
No.
No,
it wasn't about the money. The money for the gamers at that time, we had to build the trust of the gamers. We had to, you know, prove ourselves by hosting a lot of number tournaments, large number, and getting the users to believe in our platform and build the trust of the gamers, basically. So now it started like we're seeing, like, you know, users are coming on our platform and purchasing, you know, credits to play and take part in our matches and tournaments.
Yeah. So how are things going now then? When did you start? And, you know, can you share some stats, please?
We basically, I would say, prior till September, we would not host anything online. Mm-hmm. We did a few beta runs of maybe how an online tournament would happen like a few years ago, but it was mostly offline. In September, we decided to start our online platform and discard any offline events and only focus on a digital platform, because post demonetization, that really left the way for, you know, payment gateways and online payment transactions to go through. Once we started in September, and we've crossed due to Corona, the last 4 months has been an extremely high number of users. We've crossed about 1 lakh already, and now we're aiming to reach 1 million soon.
Mm-hmm. So can you tell me how many sort of games you get every day then, or do you have like certain spikes?
Yeah. So prior to COVID, we would host about 3 to 4 tournaments a day. You know, now we're hosting close to 10 to 12. We've also seen this, a huge spike, especially in the afternoon. You know, a game like the most popular games pre-Corona, I would say, was PUBG and Call of Duty. Now, I can say we've gotten more gamers from different age groups, which has led the way to Ludo King, becoming our most popular app.
In terms of the business model then, how does it work, offline as well as online? Is it two separate business models?
So currently it's all online.
Yeah, okay.
We discarded everything offline from September. It's all been online.
Yeah, okay.
So yeah, that's basically our model. We have, we're looking at also building an online ecosphere. So a lot of brand associations can also take part and have their brands endorsed, throughout our website showcased.
How have you gone about building the community?
Definitely, you have to have the infrastructure, I would say. But there are a lot of platforms today that you can build different communities in. Mm-hmm. But definitely, I would say building trust is the most important benefactor. And then providing the right community content to the community. So in our sense, for us, the content is the games. Mm-hmm. So ensuring that you have enough games to, lure in not just one type of community, but different types. Mm-hmm. So we have your mobile gamers, you have your PC gamers, and then you have your console gamers, Mm-hmm. So we try to cater towards all of them. However, India being the largest mobile base, we primarily engage in a large number of mobile tournaments first compared to PC.
Yeah, how fast are you growing then?
So it's been due to Corona. Due to the last couple of months, we've seen an insane amount of traction. Mm-hmm. I would say that compared to Jan and Feb, we had a 300% spike, especially in viewerships and in terms of new users. Mm-hmm. I think the best month was probably April.
Yeah.
After that, May was the peak, and then June and July, now so far, the unlocking has occurred. So we've seen a dip in our afternoon tournaments, where we had maybe 150 people playing one afternoon tournament, has now dipped to like 90 to 110 mm-hmm. between that range, depending on the day.
Mm-hmm. How have you scaled then? Obviously, it's coronavirus.
We've definitely had to grow our team.
Yeah.
We have a large number of tournament operators right now. Mm-hmm. So each game requires at least 4 to 5 tournament operators plus an admin. Mm-hmm. So, and we're dealing with more than 8 games right now.
Mm. Of a moment that you knew that it was going to work?
So there have been a few. I would say Corona was definitely one time when we saw everyone come on board, and we realized, that it's a time to actually do good out of it as well. That's why we actually tied up and did a couple of fundraiser tournaments, and we get it in for COVID relief. Mm-hmm. So we tied up with the Roundtable, their international association, mm-hmm. as well. And they've actually, through us, we raised above 75,000 rupees. Mm-hmm. That's about $1,000. Mm-hmm. So that was one tournament. So we hosted a few in total, which has actually helped overall, towards that as well.
Yeah. It's a competitive market. In terms of loyalty, what's stopping me from joining other platforms, as it were?
I would say our games, we're not just focusing on one game. A lot of platforms focus on just one or two games. Mm-hmm. We want to be diverse, and we want to focus and build, ensure that we are in multiple games.
How do you go about choosing the games then? Are these basically the most popular games in India then? Or?
So we actually, there have been a lot of instances where we try to aim to launch 3 games a month.
Yeah.
Out of the 3, we see how the response is, how many people like to sign up, we'll promote it. And based on that, how it performs in the next month, we'll either double the number of tournaments that we had laid out, or we'll reduce it. Mm-hmm.
Cool. Let's talk about you then, because obviously, you're not from India, you're from Greece. How did you end up in India, or the mean streets of India?
I am Indian originally, okay. But I grew up in Greece, basically. Okay. I was in Athens till I was 14. And after that, I've been living in India, and it's been great.
On average, which can I win? I was in a tournament.
So one tournament, it depends on each game.
Yeah.
And depends on the format of the game. So example, we host Call of Duty Mobile quite often, around twice a day. And it depends on the format. If we're doing a battle royale where we have 100 players and it's the last one standing, that can get over within 1 hour. But then if you have a multiplayer game, where you have a different format, and then that can go on for 3 to 4 hours. Every month, our prize pool is increasing, and we're giving out about currently now £3,000 a month, mm-hmm. and that's spread across all our games. We have about on average 10 games a day, but each game has its own dedicated prize pool.
Okay, cool. And you mentioned streaming before. I mean, that's absolutely huge.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on streaming? Seems everyone's streaming stuff these days.
Yes, definitely. I think it's a great thing. It's very engaging to the users. Mm-hmm. Everyone enjoys, watching streams, especially when we're hosting a tournament. If they lose, then they can, continue watching the match. They enjoy it. It's a great term of engagement for the users, and it's easy content to create.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. How do you deal with like upset customers then? Do you get like angry players?
Yeah, that definitely happens. We've had all kinds of customers, initially as well. I remember we have a system. We used to have one player we used to contact, when his match was there, if he's checked in. Mm. So his mom used to pick up and be like, he has an exam tomorrow. Please don't pick up. That kid, he ended up winning, I think, close to 20,000 rupees. After that, his mom used to ensure that whenever the tournament was there, like, she picked up next and she's like, yes, we'll call him immediately to ensure that he would play for his tournament.
Unbelievable. What do you feel is the most important characteristic then to be a successful esports player?
Dedication and passion towards the game. Because if you're not passionate about the game, it's going to be incredibly tough. You have to spend at least 8 hours a day training as you would for any other how any other athlete would for any other sport.
Yeah.
It's the same amount of dedication.
But would you suggest playing one game or a range of games then?
I would suggest playing one game, but it depends if the game, what type of game like is it. You may, if it's a shooting game, it might be similar to another shooting game.
Yeah.
So you could, vary your range of skills across different games. But I would say pick one game and stick to that. Mm. The other one should be because you're passionate about the games. But when you're trying to do it professionally, you should pick one game to stick to that.
Yeah, pick one game, stick to it. And you mentioned respectability, which, it is around the Western countries. When do you think it will be respectable in India then, similar to a doctor or an engineer?
It will get there. I think now COVID has definitely accelerated esports by 2 to 3 years. And I think parents are starting to realize, okay, if there is a way for kids to start earning from being at their home playing games, why not? As opposed to going outside and now, being exposed, you'd rather be ensure that your child is indoors and earning. Mm-hmm. So I think people are going to start. That's going to be one doorway, but there's a lot of other factors that are involved in this. But I think with time, this is the decade that parents in India are going to realize that this is a lucrative career option for gamers.
Mm-hmm. On average, how long does a career last then?
A career, so I would say it can start from 15 and it can get all the way up to 30, 32 years old. I know people who are up to 33, 34 who have been playing.
What's the best bit about esports then for you?
There's a lot of it. I enjoy the games. I enjoy the strategies. I enjoy seeing how people bring a different, item to the table each time in each game, a different skill set. Mm. So there's a lot of different, it's really interesting to watch and be and create. And for me, the exciting thing is that I'm able to organize these matches so that everyone gets to enjoy it. And we're building a community that we hope will be the future community and pave the way towards creating a career way for gamers ahead.
What are you like as a gamer then? What's your game?
I need to put in more time, definitely. I don't have that right now to put in. Otherwise, I would if I could. But I enjoy gaming, especially with my friends in the after I'm done with the work and stuff.
Are you like an Xbox guy or a PlayStation guy?
I'm a PlayStation guy.
Oh, okay, cool. And when it comes to mobile platforms, are you Apple or Google?
I use both for work, but I prefer the software, the iOS of Apple.
Okay, cool. Excellent. Do you think that these esports could potentially be more popular than traditional sports, you think?
Definitely.
Yeah.
It definitely is going to be. Just growing, because I think the new generation of gamers, I think they're more inclined. In terms of viewership, I'm sure if it's not already taken apart, overcrossed its current sports counterparts, it definitely will in the coming decade in terms of viewership.
Yeah. Did you think it'll be like in the Olympic Games and you think people will be like winning gold medals for like, FIFA or whatever? Or Fortnite?
I think it'll start definitely with, I definitely see it. I think, Olympics are going to have to realize that the viewership is going to soon reach hundreds of millions of viewers, if not already. Mm. And it's important to get those many eyeballs as well into the future. And there is a lot of skill, there's a lot of strategy that goes into all of these games, especially if you look at Dota 2. Like, I would say those are the games that are most likely to start in the Olympics and then go forward and diversify to the other games as well.
Yeah, yeah. What about cheating, though? You know, for example, if I create an account, I probably could get someone else to play my games for me, perhaps. I don't know.
You could, but there are a lot of ways. Soon, when you're live streaming, people are going to come to know, you know, how if someone else is playing. So I think there are a few ways that people can overcome those obstacles. And like any other sport, esports is online. So luckily, you'll be able to, you know, through online practices, be able to control and monitor.
There was a Formula One driver who got someone else to play his game.
Yeah, so I mean, that's going to happen right now. So definitely, esports will come up with these solutions, and in time, and they will ensure that you know, the legitimacy of it prevails.
Yeah, he actually got sacked as well. It was a bit harsh, actually, myself.
Don't do the crime.
Okay. In terms of the esports team, then, you know, let's say I wanted to start my own esports team. How would I do that?
Find good partners that you can communicate with to ensure that you're able to play with, and that they're able to dedicate as much time as you, and that they're as passionate as you are. That would be the first step. Once you have a good team in place, the rest will fall into place. You'll take part in online tournaments, and if you have a good relationship with the rest of your teammates, then you should be winning your tournaments or reaching top ranks.
Who are the best teams? Who are the best teams in India then?
So we have multiple, and right now we're seeing every month on our leaderboards as well. Like, that's changing, especially in different games. So I would say we have a Ludo leaderboard, and Ludo we have every month a new player. In Call of Duty, there are a few regular teams players that have won consecutively.
Are you a first-time entrepreneur?
So no, I've actually had a few other businesses that I've started, other tech startups. Mm-hmm. But you know, we tried to launch it. There were a few issues with the tech, and we overcome those. But then we realized, you know, maybe the market wasn't right or something. So I've looked at a few other apps as well before IGL. And I think each time was a great learning experience, which has put me into great use over here.
What would you say is the key takeaway from your other entrepreneurial activities?
You have to move fast, definitely. It's better to not get, you know, to launch first and get the feedback from the user and then implement that rather than perfecting your product.
It seems like you're seeking out challenges.
I mean, there's a lot I really would like to get out there, you know, and we have really a lot of not that much time out there. So I want to ensure that I'm able to like leave my mark, you know, on whatever I can.
Yeah. Yeah. What would success look like to you then?
For me, it would be probably if we, you know, get a unicorn valuation.
In terms of like the future of esports then, what would the future look like then? In say 10 years time, 20 years time, perhaps?
I think with new technologies, I think virtual reality could have a great role to play in the coming decade. Mm-hmm. Right now, it's still in its nascency. But definitely, it has a lot of scope, I think, in the towards the end of the coming decade.
What advice would you give to gamers then who want to be professional, full-time professional?
I would say first, you have to have the mindset. You have to ensure that this is what you want to do. You can't look at it half-headedly, whether should I not. Once you make the right decision that you are going to do it, then you should stick to it and, you know, ensure you put in the amount of hours and the dedication to it. So once you've done that, then you go about finding the right teammates and then taking part in these tournaments online and, you know, proving yourself that you're able to.
In terms of parents then, they probably may be concerned that, you know, kids are spending too much time playing the games. Should they be worried, do you think?
No, I think parents are soon going to realize. Right now, before COVID, they kept on saying maybe go out, play outside. But right now, because of COVID, they have had no choice but to say, you know, okay, you can play your game. They don't have any other option.
In terms of Fortnite, why was Fortnite so massive? Why did it take off?
Fortnite, I think their game, they keep on evolving it and putting out these updates, you know, so it doesn't get repetitive. They keep on changing it up. And I think that's been a key part of its success, you know. It's not just stuck to its original audience. It's changed it up. It's tried to bring on new people. And it's engaged, you know, all types of users throughout.
In terms of women, in terms of the esports, is it still rare or is it?
No. Like our player of the month for March was a girl. She took down and beat all the other guys who are like some of them in professional teams for Call of Duty. And she played other games as well on our platform. So she was really good. I think it's definitely rising. Mm-hmm. I would still say there's a high difference in the ratios, mm-hmm. but it's getting there. And I think we're going to be seeing a lot more female gamers in the coming decade.
Mm-hmm. That's good stuff. Good stuff. And you said your hobbies are DJing. Any, do you like reading books? Any books you want to recommend? Or
I've read a lot of autobiographies. Yeah. I've read Branson's, Elon's, Steve Jobs's. That was one of my favorites. Mm-hmm. Reading, autobiographies, and I read Zero to One, Peter Thiel's book. Mm-hmm. So all of these, Ray Dalio's. I think reading has really opened up my perspective to a lot of, decisions that helping in decisions, strategic decisions that you would make on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. Cool. You mentioned Steve Jobs. Some people would say he was a bit of a bully. What would you say?
I would say if you're really passionate about your idea and other people are against it, maybe, you fight for your idea no matter what. And for some people, it might come across as bullying, but for others, it's, pushing your idea out to the universe. It's not always right. It's not always right, maybe, but I think, it's basically pushing your idea if you're that passionate about it.
Last question then. For people who want more information on the Indian Gaming League, what must they do?
They can sign up on iglnetwork.com or they can check out our Instagram, iglnetwork. And they can, once you're up on our website, you can sign up or download our app, iOS or Android.
Awesome. Yash, thank you for coming on the Indian Startup Show today.
Thank you, Neil, for having me, and great talking to you.
Awesome stuff. Thank you now. Bye.
That's the end of the show. Thank you for listening and supporting the podcast. I shall be back next week. If you're building something exciting, please tell me an email, hello@neilpatel.co, or you can tweet @IndianStartupSH, or you can go to facebook.com/IndianStartupShow. Love to get. Thank you, and goodbye.